Hi everyone, and welcome to this special episode of Low Season Traveller Insider Guides. I'm your host, Jed Brown, founder of Low Season Traveller, and some of you may know that we work very closely with both the World Tourism Association for Culture and Heritage and also My Travel Research. As part of this relationship, we've been organising a series of tourism recovery webinars where we're speaking to global industry leaders from the tourism industry and we're seeking to learn how we can come out of this current situation with more resilience. Our second keynote of the series was with Chris Flynn, who's the President and CEO of the World Tourism Association for Culture and Heritage. And as with episode one, this is the Q&A session which followed the keynote. I hope you find this interesting, and we'll bring you the Q&A from every session as we move forward. Enjoy.
Into a Q&A, if I'm not mistaken, Jed?
We are indeed. Chris, that was a fantastic presentation. Thank you so much for that. Really interesting to see, you know, of all of those, you know, crises that you were showing there and that we've been talking about, one thing which really comes through on all of those slides is the incredible resilience of the travel industry. And you know what you were showing there in terms of you know, not only the drops but how quickly in many cases the tourism arrivals were bouncing back. Is COVID-19 the ultimate test of this for want of a better word, bounce back ability of the sector? Is this well, it's certainly the sternest test we've ever faced, right?
Absolutely. You know, you can't really imagine things on a scale that what we're seeing right now. And I know that there are people out there that will be thinking that maybe we could get back to normal quickly, but that's not going to happen. And there are people that might think that there's going to be a lot of pent-up demand, and there is, but it's going to be more pent-up aspiration and desire, because the amount of people who could afford to travel again post this is going to be significantly less, because it's not only the crisis of COVID-19, it's the financial crisis as well, and so many people being out of work. So what we're going to see is a transition as people begin to travel. Once they begin to step out of the front door again, if you will, they tend to travel domestically first. They find their feet, and it builds confidence. The next step will be to travel a bit further, maybe regionally. So if I was in Manchester like you, Jed, I might jump on a plane and head out to Europe a little bit. What we found with SARS and the recovery time with SARS was that people were reluctant to travel any great distance initially for fear that they might get trapped again. And we've seen during the COVID-19 scenario already how many people have been stranded around the world, how many people have needed to be, you know, rescued, if you will, and brought back to their home countries around the world. So this kind of underlying fear, this kind of underlying anxiety will be around for a while. So to answer your question, this is going to be the ultimate test. But I also believe if we get it right, it's the ultimate opportunity.
Very good. There's some questions starting to come through, Chris, online now. So I'm going to start to take you through some of those. We've got a question here from Sanjay Kinney. With the new social distancing norms, will leisure tourists be willing to travel to densely populated countries like India and China? What do you think?
Sanjay, thank you for your question. Eventually, yes. Initially, no. Again, it comes down to this fear of the unknown. Also, there's certain things at the moment, you know, transparency issues. Rightly or wrongly, you know, if one government is less transparent than another, we don't really know what the numbers are. And when we're talking about, you know, huge populations of, you know, 1.3 billion in India and these crowded cities, I don't think people are going to be comfortable going back to those kind of areas immediately. It's going to take some time. Having said that, this is where the opportunity is there for a destination to rethink how they promote, how they sell, how they position, what kind of tourists they want. Do they want mass tourism, or do they want a more, you know, sort of quality focused tourist? These are the kind of question and answers that we're going to be asking over the coming months. But really, Sanjay, I very much doubt that people are going to be wanting to rush back into crowded environments anytime soon if the threat of COVID-19 is still literally in the air.
Do you think as a society, we're, you know, again, the world over, we're all in a similar position. We're all in these lockdowns. Do you think there are signs that we are starting to change how we view, I suppose, crowded situations? You know, I find already when I'm looking at TV programs that are obviously recorded pre-COVID-19, and, you know, you see big crowds of people together and people are hugging and embracing and whatever else just on a TV program, you know, I almost kind of wince because already I am, in a very short space of time, I'm kind of quite conditioned to keeping away from other people. So here in Manchester, you know, we're allowed to go for a walk every day. I go for my walk, and, you know, yeah, I'm crossing over the street if there's somebody on the same side of the path as me, which is quite strange because usually I'd always say good morning or whatever as you pass. And now I'm actually, you know, going out of my way to avoid being anywhere near them. You know, are we actually going to start getting a little bit more conditioned into that? And is that going to be in our framework, either subconsciously or consciously?
I think with any crisis that happens, it's not just a change of circumstance or condition. It's a change of mindset. It's a behavioral change. And like you, Jed, I'm seeing this here in Sydney itself. You know, I go to my supermarket, and usually when you go up an escalator, there's 100 people running up there and squeezing past them. And I'm usually one of them, you know. Yeah. But now everybody stays on the escalator with their 1.5-meter space. Nobody rushes. Everybody takes their time. And people tend to be more respectful of each other. Respectful of each other's circumstance and space. And I think this kind of behavioral change and change of mentality, if you will start to play out in the tourism offerings that we offer in the future. I don't think people are going to want to go back to crazy, crowded situations that we've seen, particularly in some of the areas of Europe, or the over-tourism issues that we've seen elsewhere. People are now starting to see, you know, a blanket lift in terms of pollution and overcrowding and what have you. And that's really what they want. In my own opinion is that tourism has grown sort of exponentially over the years without the checks and balances we really need. You know, a lot of the tours and holidays that are sold really are not delivering what's on the tin, if you will. They're not delivering what's advertised. People are going into situations and into resorts that are crowded with people. Nobody really wants that. So maybe this is a chance for us to reset things, to press the reset button, and to work with destinations, to work with tour operators, to work with industry, to try to change and mold the industry for what it should be.
That kind of links on to another question that we've had through from Mohammed Shukavant. Hi, Mohammed, and thank you for the question. How could operators adapt themselves with customers' psychological changes? How should tourism activists come into connectivity? I suppose that's linked to what we were just talking about there, really.
It is. It's kind of, thank you, Mohammed, for the question. It kind of links to what we were saying there with the behavioral change and with the change of psychology. I suppose to some degree, less is more. I would say that tour numbers or group numbers would probably be less. The price would probably be more, but the quality and the value would be vastly different in terms of those two aspects, the quality and the value. So what we will probably lose on volume as such in terms of yield, revenue, we can gain on quality and yield.
Yep. The questions are flooding in, Chris. You'll be glad to know. Let me get to another way. Right, good question, Stu Spears. Can you elaborate a little on what you see as the opportunities that are coming out of this? Great question, Stu.
Yes, thanks, Stu. Again, this is the opportunities that I see, Stu, are really in terms of responsible tourism, sustainable tourism. Now, this isn't a quick fix. This is not instant coffee. It's not going to happen overnight. But again, I think there's organizations out there, including, you know, WETAC. We focus on culture and heritage, and it's all to do with protecting what we've got. A lot of what we have, including culture, environment, once it's gone, it's gone. We have a chance to take a breath. We have a chance to take a step back and to work with destinations and particularly governments on how to move forward on this. One of the big issues is that the majority of ministers around the world, particularly those who focus on tourism, don't like to have any kind of negative growth on their watch. They don't really look at the value. They don't really look at the yield. They just don't want to have to say, oh, well, we got less, you know, our visitor arrivals last year were minus 5%. We have to change that conditioning. We have to change that mentality. We have to explain to these key decision makers that it's about quality. It's about the protection of environment, species, culture, heritage, those assets that are irreplaceable. And if we can start to put those in place, that, Stu, in my opinion, will be where we make the greatest leap forward in terms of tourism in the future.
Great, great question again. Another question for Chris. This is from Stephen Eccleston. For Chris, what kind of, this is the $1 million question. What kind of time frame do you estimate for international travel recovery? I suppose, I'll add, if I may, Stephen, if you'll forgive me, I'll add to that is, you know, there's a time frame for recovery, but also, are we actually ever going to see a full recovery, do you think?
That is a good question. And of course, it's an unknown. And it's right. It's why I wanted to show what happened in SARS or during SARS, because SARS, you know, effectively lasted for 2 months. The recovery time in terms of aviation and room nights, etc., took a year. This is going to take years, and it won't go back to how it was, and maybe it shouldn't go back to how it was. It's going to take time. It's going to take careful planning. And another thing that we learned during SARS, which I think is quite important, is when it comes to consumers and travelers, and when it comes to their decision making, or, you know, in terms of should we travel, what we found was that when destinations themselves, affected destinations, announced that they were SARS free and hey, we're open for your business and please come back, everybody, nobody really believed them. And that's why we saw the continued fall in July and August, etc. Because of course there's self-interest in that message. Of course you want people to come back, it drives your economy. We found that what was more effective was having third-party endorsement. It might be UNWTO, it might be the World Trade Organization, it might be WETAC, it could be all of these organizations that work with destinations but don't have any skin in the game as such. They don't have anything to gain from this. So part of how you communicate your message, how you position yourself post COVID-19, requires the assistance and support of third-party endorsement. To come back to your question, Stephen, how long is it going to take? It's going to take years.
There's been so many. It's such a popular question, and you know I've heard it myself bandied around, and it's the $1 million question that everybody wants to know. My feeling is that I nearly hope it's the case that it's not going to recover to 2019 levels for years. But the hope is that we can, I suppose, at least recover in the right way and come out of it a little bit better. Sorry, Chris.
I was going to say, because everybody, it doesn't matter who it is in this industry, everybody has to do a rethink now. There is no get out of jail free card on this one. every single destination, tour operator, travel company has to rethink this. So I think you're going to start to see a pattern emerge in the way that we start to recover. And hopefully we won't go back, as you say, to some of those crazy days in these incredibly overcrowded areas.
It links actually to, just again squeezing through, there's been a couple of comments similar to this. This one's Jason Hill. Is over-tourism going to be a problem again in the future? Or do you think destinations will actually use this as an opportunity to manage things differently to negate this? When demand disappears, it is hard to focus on sustainability.
That's true. Well, that's a fantastic observation, Jason. It is hard to focus on sustainability, and that's why I said that kind of process is not instant coffee. That's got to run parallel to everything that we do. Of course, we've got to get back on that ladder and start to climb. It's how we start to climb that ladder and what our key considerations are as we start to climb that ladder. If we climb that ladder with blinkers and we just want to go back to the way we were, I think those are the destinations that will suffer the most because of that behavioral change that we're seeing, that change in consumer psychology that we're seeing. This is what's going to drive demand in the future. And demand isn't all about numbers. Demand covers a whole range of different things. So, sustainability will run parallel, get up the ladder, but do it in a more responsible way. That's the way I see it.
Yep.
Did that answer the question, by the way? Not quite sure.
I think so. I'm sorry, I'm trying to... It's so hard. I'm trying to focus on reading the questions as I'm listening to you, and it's really hard. So many questions, which is great, and that's the most important thing. And that's why I just want to make sure that everybody gets to have their questions addressed at least. This is from Kevin Murphy. Is that reset you're suggesting likely to reduce numbers and considerably from the IVAs of 2018-19, and by how much? 20%, 30%, or not at all? Those are your three options, Chris. Because not too much will change by those who will have survived in the business. Is the reset likely to reduce numbers and considerably from the IVAs of 2018-19?
Absolutely. Of course it will. Yeah. And one of the main reasons why the numbers are going to be reduced is because a lot of the systems that are in place or were in place pre-COVID-19 are not going to be there. Yeah. I mean, I read yesterday, Lufthansa, the national carrier of Germany, is looking for a bailout over the next 48 hours. Otherwise, it's going to go into administration. The low-cost airlines that we see around the world, how many of them are going to be around, if any? So from a sheer capacity issue in terms of transportation, that's going to be driving, demand and growth and what have you. And the volume that was there pre-COVID-19 just isn't going to be there. So those percentage numbers, 20, 30% or zero, can't really comment on that because we don't know who's going to exist in the future. I think it was Bill Gates who about 10 years ago now, he said that he saw in the future that there'd be mass consolidation within the international airline structure. And he estimated that, I think it was around about 2025 or something like that, that there would only be between 10 and 12 major international airlines in operation. Now, I don't think he was factoring in a pandemic, but that could be a scenario that we see, mass consolidation of airlines around the world.
It's interesting, actually. We've spoken to, we've got John Grant of Midas Aviation, and he also does work, of course, with OAG. And obviously, we've got him on the series later on to specifically talk about aviation. But I've spoken to John Grant about this, and I think the feeling is out there that, there's 300 major commercial airlines in the world today. And I think the feeling is that there was never really enough to justify that. The financial models and the economics of running an airline, they're really not very profitable. It's not a very profitable side of the industry to be in. And I think the feeling was that there was always too many airlines in the world. And it contributed to this over-tourism that we saw and these, you said it before yourself, Chris, you know, if I can fly from Manchester to Dublin for the price of a Starbucks coffee, there's something wrong. You know, there's something massively messed up in the system. And it is, and it's the fact that, you know, we've been keeping these, you know, we've been keeping these airlines afloat almost artificially for so many years that it was almost going to take some big change in the world for the house of cards literally to come falling down. And I think, you know, COVID-19, that is the gust of wind that's blowing it all down. And, you know, I think you might have seen it as well, but for our listeners out there, if you haven't seen it, it's worth looking up on LinkedIn. There was a report by Credit Suisse, which said that the liquidity of most of the major airlines had was for about 3 months. And if they held on to all of the money which they're currently got for future travel, if they or travel that hasn't been provided, if they could hold on to that, it would give them liquidity for maybe 5 months, maybe 6 months. If they had to pay it out, then obviously they're in a very precarious position.
Peter Harbison from CAPA, Centre of Aviation Pacific, whatever it is, did a report probably about a month ago, and CAPA estimated that by the end of May, 90% of global airlines will have disappeared or will have been in administration. But coming back to your point then about, you know, if you can travel to Manchester, Dublin for a price of a cup of coffee, there is something wrong with that. But not only that, it lessens the quality of the tourism itself. If you have that kind of mass tourism, spending that kind of money, the quality of the visitor itself gets called into question. That in turn impacts the reputation of the destination. So do we really want to go back to that kind of scenario, or are we willing to, you know, maybe buy two cups of coffee and fly to Dublin?
Do you think this is linked to a question from it's so small on my screen, everybody. I'm really struggling, and I wear glasses as well. I forget who said it. Sorry, I can't find it. Is there an opportunity here for small regional destinations in Australia and everywhere else in the world that, you know, frequently in the past, maybe they get overlooked for the big shiny destinations? Have they got an opportunity now like they've never had before to welcome guests in a sustainable manner? And, you know, really, I suppose, in a way, if capitalize is the right word, capitalize on this situation.
I think so. And that's exactly how they should be thinking. You know, a lot of regions and smaller towns, you know, play fiddle to the larger destinations, and they try to, for want of a better phrase, pick up the scraps of what they can get. With the processes that are in place in terms of how people will begin to travel or return to travel post this crisis. As I said earlier, there will be growth in domestic. As people start to travel again, they will naturally go domestically. So you can pick up some growth there. But I think the big opportunity is when people start to expand a little bit further. So when they start to look at regional travel, whether that's regional within a country or whether it's regional sort of into a particular region, whether that's Asia or Europe or whatever, this is that's the time to really start to capitalize on getting access to those people. Because as I said, people are going to want more unique experiences. They're going to want less crowds. They're going to want to feel safer in these kinds of destinations. So from a regional perspective, I think this presents itself as an ideal opportunity to rewrite the book, if you will. Mm.
It's, I mean, really, I guess this is a really great opportunity for niche travel, like never before, which actually gives, I suppose, smaller organizations an opportunity like they could have never dreamt of, because now you don't have to be a big guy to, you know, to be, and in fact, actually, the big guys, they're probably ones which are getting harmed the most in all of this. And when I say the big guys, I mean the large tour operators, the large airlines. They're the ones that are being hurt the most by this. Is that right? Or are the smaller guys getting hurt just as much? Who is hurting the most from this? Who is suffering the most from this? And the only reason I ask that question is to try and ascertain you know, where there is the biggest opportunity as we come out of it?
Well, one of the things, I mean, simple answer is everybody's hurting from this, but the way the industry has developed and the way the industry was operating for so many years, the big boys had the purchasing capacity, as you know, whether that's a distribution chain, travel agencies, wholesalers, and whatever. And they basically held all the cards. They could demand what they want. And if you couldn't provide them with what they want, they would just go elsewhere. I think what we're going to find now, it's not going to be level completely, don't get me wrong, but we're going through a leveling process now. You could use the term a level playing field, but this is a leveling process. This is a time when everyone will take a step back and reanalyze how they do business, how they did business, and how they want to do business moving forward. I think some of the things that you're going to see, we haven't even thought about yet. You remember, you know, the disruption caused by Airbnb and, you know, other disruptive companies that sort of suddenly appeared on our tourism radar. You're going to see so much more of that coming through. So the innovation side of the transition from COVID-19 is going to be very interesting to watch, because as we have to start doing things different, this is where the new models will start to take place and the new experiences will start to emerge. So yeah, it's going to be very interesting to watch. Again, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't say with any authority what's going to happen in the future. Nobody knows that. But these are the kind of things that we'll start to see.
I suppose that whole, you know, the lack of a crystal ball, that is what we are all struggling with in this industry, in every industry, actually, is the fact that when you're in unprecedented times, you know, you can have as much experience in the world as you like, but if it's a situation that's never been faced before, you know, it's very hard to understand how it's going to play out when nobody's ever been through it. And I suppose it links with, again, we've got a session coming up later on in the series, which is more about the data side of it. And that, I suppose, is where, you know, data is incredibly valuable right now, because that, you know, we discussed it before off air, Chris, facts, not fear. You know, it's about what's real, and the data that you see is real, and there are some amazing data sets out there.
Yeah, it's it is the word unprecedented, you know, keeps getting raised, and it is, and we don't know how we're going to transition out of this. But the other thing about, again, the series that we're running, these 12 part series, is that as we run the series with the information that we find out, we mold that into the sessions that we're going to deliver. So we're trying to keep sort of like our knowledge base current as best we can and work that into the discussion process. It is going to be incredibly difficult, Jed, and as we've said before, we just don't know who's going to be there at the end of this. And so if you don't know that, how can you plan?
Yeah, that's part of the challenge. A great question here from, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Hiroko Suboy Friedman. What would be an inspiration for people to travel right now? So as we're coming out of this, thinking about how people are going to travel and how we're going to inspire them as an industry to travel, what would bring people to get interested to travel? Safety, curiosity, fulfilling experiences. What do you think is going to inspire people to actually travel, albeit nervously, as we first crawl out of this situation?
Well, first of all, honesty has to be out there. Truthfulness in terms of destinations, from a safety aspect and from an experience aspect. I think the word authenticity is thrown around a lot, but I think people, when they start to travel, I think it was Kevin Murphy earlier on who said that, you know, those who have the propensity to travel and the wealth to travel are not going to be affected as much as others. So what do they want? They want a quality experience, an authentic experience. I think that this whole idea of protection, this Mother Earth kind of thing, sits within the heart of all of us, really. And I'm not trying to preach, I'm not trying to say anything like this, but I think that coming from a crisis, the value of things will change. You know, I remember, well, not remember, but, you know, Second World War, my parents, when they came out of the Second World War and they had 5 years of rationing and everything else, their behavior changed. And it's still like that today. You know, my mother would hate me for saying this, but she hasn't thrown anything out for the last 50 years into her wardrobe jam-packed. You know, it's all to do with this change of mindset. Mm. So as we go through this change of mindset, that people will naturally start to become more conscious of the environment, more conscious of safety, more conscious of the need to protect, more conscious of the need to keep things safe. So Hiroko, it's a very, very good question. I think honesty, authenticity, truthfulness, and having something that's genuine will be, hopefully, the way destinations will start to emerge from this. Let's call it responsible and quality tourism.
Yep. Carolyn, our producer behind the scenes, are there any pertinent questions, Carolyn, that I'm missing out on?
Jed, there are so many, I'm not even sure where to begin. I mean, the quality of the questions, again, has just been so fabulous. So let me just run through and see. I'm having a laugh at Kevin's suggestion about the experience that will come back. He's suggesting missionary work. we've got some questions, some references, which I think pick up on some of the stuff earlier in terms of social distance and the infrastructure changes that we might need to take into account. Whether either of you want to comment on that?
I'd like to add something to that, if I may, because when we talk about the world traveling again, and people are sort of saying, oh, you know, once we sort of get over the pig's back, as we would say around here, of this, we should be able to start traveling again. Part of me wonders, you know, at the airports, you know, we saw after 9/11, Chris, you know, the security at airports just changed irreversibly. And, you know, in the industry, we talked about what travel was like pre-9/11 and post-9/11. What do you think is going to be the kind of changes that we're going to see? I mean, airports already, and I work with airports, and with respect to all of my aviation colleagues, you know, it's hell. No one's enjoying going through airports these days, generally speaking. Is that experience, if we didn't think it could get worse, is that about to get a whole lot worse, Chris?
I think it is. You know, and of course, that experience is the introduction to your holiday or your business trip or whatever. But I can't see how it's going to get less. You know, if we start to factor in, you know, these kinds of issues such as the COVID-19, and it's really about the having or creating a bubble of confidence for travelers so they feel safe to travel. And that, how we do that, you know, we'll have to wait and see what technology is sort of developed to assist that. But as we know, these kind of rules and regulations change constantly. Rarely are they consistent at any airport in the world. So, you know, one of the things that I don't think is mentioned enough in terms of transitioning from COVID-19 is leadership. Now, we've looked around the world in various different politics around the world, and we've seen great leadership and we've seen terrible leadership. The quality of leadership in terms of how tourism transitions out of this, I think, is paramount to this, because it's the leaders of our industry who are going to be driving the policies, who are going to be supporting, going to provide the recommendations on what we need to do as an industry, as an airport, as a destination. So that is a critical part of how we transition from this. It's the, rather than just make it up as we go along, as we've done in the past, there needs to be a plan or a series of plans that enable us to get to where we need to be. But no, it's not going to get any easier.
Just as you're talking there, I'm thinking, is that going to happen? Because you're absolutely right. Something as important, you know, pre-COVID-19 as security, you know, the threat of terrorism, etc., absolutely critical. Yet, if I'm going to the States, I have to take off my shoes before I get on a flight, but I don't have to if I'm in parts of Asia and in parts of Europe. Sometimes I'm challenged on the amount of liquids I can take. Other times I'm not as much. There's no consistency on that kind of stuff. If you equate that out onto the health side and the screening side, if there's no consistency, doesn't work, does it? I mean, this literally can only work if it's an absolute coordinated approach. And as far as I can see at the moment across the world, I'm not seeing a huge amount of coordination. I'm not seeing, you know, effectively like a, you know, a G20 summit of all the tourism ministers getting together to combine their knowledge. I'm not seeing that kind of collaboration and cooperation at the moment. So if that's not going to happen, how are we going to get there?
I don't know. I mean, I was expecting to see some kind of announcements from ICAO, in terms of, aviation and the way things operate right now. I've not seen anything. The silence has been deafening for the most part. Sorry, Caroline.
Yeah. Beyond infrastructure relating to the actual process of transport, I think one of the things the questioner was also thinking about was not just the on the way to the destination, but things when we get to the destination. So are hotels going to have to look different? How are we going to manage? So you think about now, I mean, okay, you know, I think about the hotels in China, some of the lobbies there, you could literally could social distance in some of them. But I think if you look at the move towards something like boutique hotels, art series hotels, those kind of things, you know, you're not going to be able to check in more than a couple of people in some of those areas. So do we think there's a broader place thing? Because one of the things that struck me in some of the literature is our cities changed after the great plagues of, basically the last 2,000 years. Are we going to see that reflect in the way that we design hotels, the way we design experiences going forward, do we think?
You know, just as you were talking there, Carolyn, one thing flashed in my mind, which I'd never thought about before, never even considered. But when we look at some of the larger hotels around the world, and, you know, there's so many in Asia, when you look at the elevators that take you up to the 60th floor or whatever, how are we going to cope with that? Social distancing in elevators in hotels is just one example. How are we going to keep the flow of guests moving around properties in a safe but efficient way? I have no idea at this stage. I wouldn't know.
But it'd be, I'd say it's probably a great time to be a hotel designer right now, because there'll be a lot of work that needs to be done.
More boutique resorts, two levels maximum.
And an airport designer. You know, there's been a lot of talk about this, you know, this stuff about, you know, I mean, O'Leary over here in Europe has obviously mocked the idea, and I think quite rightly so, about this, you know, skip the middle seat.
One of the questions we have here.
Is that one of the questions? Whoever it was, that's a really great point, because obviously this whole skipping the middle seat, Chris, I mean, come on, it's got to be garbage. You know, you're going to have the seats in front of you. Either way, that would mean you're removing about a sixth of the capacity, or a third actually of the capacity of an aircraft. And, you know, the low cost carriers, again, for all of our listeners out there that aren't as close to aviation, you know, the low cost carriers, they have to make that model work, they have to run at a minimum of 95% seat capacity. So 95% of people actually on the seats in the plane. Is this all missing the middle aisle seat? Is this just a load of garbage, Chris?
That's not going to work. I mean, I saw a report today on flights, domestic flights within the US. They're still operating. There are still some operating. The average load factor, because of social distancing and what have you, that operated last week was 10 people on a flight. It went massively increased this week. It went to 17.
It just doesn't work. I mean,
It doesn't work. So the quality control in terms of the health risk, if that makes sense, is a vital part of the profitability of how airlines and other transport operators are going to have to work in the future, because it's the same for trains and it's the same for everybody else, for buses and everything else. So there has to be some kind of mechanism, health mechanism, established or determined to allow it to happen. What kind of technology or what kind of advice that requires, I don't know. But you can see the World Health Organization having to play a massive part in part of this leadership planning. So to work in conjunction with ICAO, IATA, CLIA, et cetera, to try and determine how they can move forward profitably and safely at the same time. It's a tough one. But middle seat, ain't going to happen.
Yeah, it's, like you say, especially when you're probably, less than 1 meter away from the seat in front or the seat behind you. When I saw that come out, I was just thinking, this is just a publicity stunt or something. I mean, it just can't work.
Okay, think about a flight here, and this is not me trying to be sort of rude or crude or anything like that. But when we're on a flight, most of us all have to go to the bathroom. What happens when you go to the bathroom on a plane? You have half the aisle at the back of the plane or the front of the plane full of people queuing up next to people on seats, next to each other. How are they going to do that? Is it going to be a ticket system? There needs to be systems in place that allow that negate the risk that we're seeing right now with COVID-19 or any other kind of transmissible disease.
Chris, could I play devil's advocate there for a moment, which is those of us who are old enough to remember when British Airways launched the first flatbeds in business class. And I remember at the time, A, being in awe that they'd actually taken the step that travellers had wanted, and B, going, they must be bloody insane. The economics of this make no sense. And then what happened over time was more and more people came in and found out ways to use the space differently. Again, I wonder if we're going to see ways that we will use it differently. I don't know that we'll ever go back to sardines. I did have this vague thought was whether suddenly airlines will start asking you to sign a waiver, i.e. if you get COVID-19, it's not our fault if you want to sit and have cheap air transport. But my reaction is sometimes, and you touched on this earlier in your innovation, some of the innovation stuff, and of course we will have Tammy Marshall talking innovation, which is whether the very fact of survival will make people think innovatively about how we use that space. I mean, Air New Zealand in our part of the world, great example now, economy class, they've got this thing where their seats will convert into a bed. If you buy two of the seats, the third one, the middle seat does disappear and it becomes a bed that you just have to be pretty friendly with the other person, but you can spoon together in those seats. And so, I look at it and say there may be some innovative airlines out there who are doing that at the moment.
Yeah. Profit always drives innovation. And, we're going to have to see some very creative ways, I think, of how we're going to do this. And this is all part of us not going back to the way it was.
Great. Now, I've got a really interesting question here from Angelica, which I'm going to share. She's going, what kind of research into sustainability in terms of the sociology, so the human factors, sociology and behavioural approach is going to be necessary for our new world? So how are we going to get people to behave differently and train people to behave differently?
To be honest with you, Caroline, I think you're probably, with your skill set, I think you're probably best to answer that. But the way I would look at it initially is the fact that, just coming back to what I was saying earlier, that we're going to see behavioral change anyway. It's already starting to happen. How that transitions into behavior in terms of visiting a destination, I think a lot of that will come down to how visitation is managed by those destinations and what kind of visitor and how many numbers they want. So, this profitless volume kind of model that we've had in the past, hopefully, I think, has gone for good. Angelica, that is a tricky question, and I think Caroline, ironically, is probably better to answer that than I am.
Okay, well, let's make it a conversation, because I think one of the things that I would say, Angelica, is actually we do have quite a lot of broader, governments all over the world are investing in using the whole behavioral insights thinking. So there's, we've got quite a lot of thinking in that broader policy space that we can draw on. So we know we're using this to reach, we're using get people to get better ways to pay their taxes. So one little sentence different in a letter actually netted UK Treasury £70 million more. So we actually have a lot of those frameworks starting to emerge already. So I think we'll actually be knocking on the doors of the nudge units, as they're sometimes known, all over the world, to start saying, look, how do we get people to do that? And I think we'll need to be bringing more of that thinking into our design of things. So how do we get people to behave in the ways that we do? And some of that's context, some of that's changing things. But I do think it's also the change, maybe, Angelica, is, and I wonder if this was your intention, was also we need to change the thinking and nudge the thinking of the industry. And in a sense, that's what I think this pandemic will do. One of the things that's interesting is there's been a lot of conversation about whether this pandemic, you know, people talk about it being a black swan or it's come from out of the blue. It absolutely has not. World Health Organization has been talking about this for what, 10 years now? We are seeing dozens and dozens of things happen that are there, and we can expect the panel on species diversity came out this week and said we can expect more and more of these pandemics more and more frequently if we keep pushing into wild areas. So I think we actually need to change the mindset of the policymakers first, and then we can change the mindset of the customers because they can have that. But I think we've got tools, we've got units full of incredibly clever people who are working on this right now. I know we've got a few academics on the call. I'd be saying go back and start thinking about this. And Angelica, if you are one of those people, I think I'd start preparing some courses and some training and get some really smart PhD students on it right now. Jed, Chris, did you want to add anything on that one?
No, I think that that was concise and straight to the point. Yeah. I think that was some really good information there, Carolyn. Thank you.
Well, just while you were talking there, Carolyn, as well, a great point coming from Nigel Fell. Appreciate it will take some time, but will a vaccine be the catalyst for tourism to start again and therefore travel to just go back to business as usual? And I must admit, I think it's a fantastic point because, you know, we're talking about, you know, social distancing and how, look, you can't do it in aircraft. Somebody else has raised a point there. You can't do it on coach travel, rail travel. You know, that's not ultimately going to be the answer. Surely the answer is either, you know, rigorously testing and I guess screening of people before they get on the aircraft. And then, you know, if you know and have confidence that there's nobody else on that aircraft that has got this, then it's okay to sit as we used to sit. So is Nigel's point there that, you know, look, once we have a vaccine, it can go back to normal? And is that then the risk that it does actually go back to normal?
Is that for me? All right. Okay. I suppose it is.
Anybody.
I was drifting off then. Nigel, thanks. Thanks for the question. It's a really interesting one. But again, you know, I listening and looking at what's going on in terms of vaccines and you know, the, you know, what is it? It might take a year to have a quality vaccine be developed. Of course, that's going to help. Absolutely. Will it fix a problem? I don't really know. I mean, at the moment, we're all quarantined, you know, for minimum 14 days when we get off a boat or a plane. It was announced yesterday that they found out that the coronavirus lives in the nasal cavities for over 3 weeks. So those 14-day quarantines are kind of null and void a little bit. So the whole idea of the vaccine is one thing. How we dispel the fear and the anxiety that this is going to create is another. And that's the key for me. And I don't know what the answer is for that. And as Jed just said earlier, you know, you can't do this on a train or you can't do this on a bus. I don't know. I'd like to think so, Nigel. I'd like to think that is the answer. That is the silver bullet. But I don't know.
One of the things that I've been saying, because I've been talking about this in the, you know, travelers as whatever normal will look like going forward for a while. And I think one of the things is that we do need to reflect on a little bit. And sorry if this, you know, sounds a bit like tough love. A lot of the things that are going to happen are about all of the sum of all the individual choices that we make. So I can't say it's down to all of us and no one else, but I do think that all of the decisions that we all make as the industry are going to be that. And the advocacy that we do and what we're willing to tolerate will drive some of that. And even at an elite level, at a policy level, for example, here in Australia, the debate to when and how to shut down the economy, they pulled together a national cabinet, and it's fairly clear that some of the more rigorous social distancing were driven by the two states that had the highest incidence of this, and they persuaded the Prime Minister to go harder, which I think we've, you know, all lived to be grateful for. This will sound amazing to the rest of the world, but those of you who saw David Bearman's numbers on Tuesday, you know, we are in panic in Australia because we've reached 88 deaths for the whole country. But I think that, what made that work was Australians got behind this. We still have a total support for doing this. And we're starting to get bored. I noticed this morning that when I went out to take exercise, that there were more cars on the road. But substantially, our individual actions have all added up to that. So don't underestimate the individual things that all of us can do. We can't do it on our own. And there are powerful forces out there that we know. But if each of us did something about this, the chances of tipping it the way we want it to go would be greater.
So there we have it. Huge thanks again go to Chris Flynn at the World Tourism Association for Culture and Heritage and Carolyn Childs from My Travel Research. The full episode can be viewed online at tiny.cc/WTACH, and you can register for the future episodes, which will be running throughout May on Tuesdays and Thursdays. The third special episode in this series is with Professor John Kaldowski, who is one of the tourism industry's leading analysts, and he'll be providing his insights into what we can expect in the future. Until then, have a great week, stay healthy, stay safe, stay home, and don't forget to share this podcast with your friends, family, and social networks. Our content will always be free for everyone, as we believe that travel is better without the crowds.